All right, we're ready to begin. Aloha and welcome to Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis. I'm today's host, Stanley Chang, and I chair the Hawaii Senate Committee on Housing. Thank you, everyone, for your patience while we were sorting out our technical difficulties. Today, our special guest is Kenzie Bock, the administrator for the Boston Housing Authority, the public housing authority for the city of Boston, Massachusetts. Prior to joining the Boston Housing Authority, she served two terms as the Boston City Councilor for District 8, leading as chair of the committees on Ways and Means, Pilot, Boston's COVID-19 Recovery, and City Services and Innovation Technology. Today, she'll be discussing the city's ambitious plan to address its housing shortage by building 3,000 new federal public housing units that will incorporate mixed income, revenue-neutral development financed by revolving funds, making it a much more financially sustainable model than previous generations of subsidized housing. And I understand this is a centerpiece of Mayor Michelle Wu's housing plan. One final housekeeping note, we will be taking questions, so please enter them into the Q&A function of the Zoom. Kenzie, we're very thankful to you for sharing your insights with us, so please take it away.
Senator, thank you so much for having me. And it's lovely to be here with your audience. Again, I'm Kenzie Bock, head of the Boston Housing Authority. I think across the country in high cost areas, we are all struggling with the same challenges. And so it's really great when we have opportunities like this to get together and share knowledge. So as you alluded to, Mayor Wu, who's our mayor here in Boston, has really made housing number one priority. And I think has really encouraged us to think big. And to recognize that, you know, not addressing the housing crisis is not an option. And I think that we all have to think about the fact that kind of just continuing to do what we have been doing isn't working. And so we have to try to, you know, go bigger. I wanted to just start for a couple of minutes just by scene setting, because I know most of the audience is not from Boston. And then I'll throw up some slides and talk a little bit about the details of what we're doing on Faircloth. So in Boston, we have about 10,000 public housing units that we own. The city, the housing authority owns. And then roughly another 4,000 that we're passing through public housing subsidy to, and another 19,000 vouchers. Here in Boston, we actually have state public housing and state vouchers in addition to federal public housing and federal vouchers, which makes us very unusual. Most states don't have state public housing or a state voucher program. So we administer all of those sources. So we are housing about 30,000 families through either subsidy or direct owned properties here at the housing authority. But we, of course, face like a huge housing crisis at every level. And you know, one of the things that we're seeing in Boston is not just that we need more housing for very low income folks, but that even when very low income folks start to make a little bit more money, the ones who live in our housing can't actually move anywhere else because sort of rungs 2, 3, 4, 5 of the housing ladder are all broken. So I just wanna reflect on the fact that while I'll be talking today mostly about Faircloth units, which are deeply subsidized federally backed units for our lowest income folks, which, you know, that's really the housing authorities focused on getting housed. We really recognize here in Boston that there's the whole housing ecosystem all relates to each other, and you can't pit one part against the other or just say, let's just solve this piece of the puzzle. Because when you do that, we've got a situation here where we've got, you know, we used to have 10% turnover in public housing every year, and now it's in the very low single digits because nobody can go anywhere else. And that means that our wait lists just grow. So the Boston Housing Authority has a 42,000 person wait list. Today. So, you know, I just want to start out with a little bit of that so that folks have a sense of what the scale of the problem looks like here. Boston is one of the most expensive cities in the country. You know, from my perspective, one of the key mistakes of the past is that we stopped building public housing. When we talked about kind of a housing building program overall, we'd sort of left it to the market, and predictably the market didn't take care of the lower end. And so we are definitely getting the Boston Housing Authority back in the business of public development. But as I try to remind everyone, that's actually the business that we were founded to be in and that we've been in for more decades than we haven't. So the Housing Authority in Boston, we built 1,000 units in the 1930s, 4,500 units in the 1940s, 5,500 in the 1950s, 1,600 in the 60s, then 2,200 in the 70s. Then we built 300 units in the 1980s, and our last new development opened in 1983. And so for the last 40 years, we haven't built new public housing at all. We've only redeveloped existing units, largely to the net result of losing units. So that's how we've come to have almost 3,000 units, 2,964 in Faircloth authority, which is basically those who aren't familiar with the term, there's a 1999 amendment passed to federal law, which told every housing authority in the country that they couldn't have more public housing ever than they had that day in 1999. So we all got a Faircloth number, every housing authority across the country. And that was actually meant to be a way to put a stop, sort of a cap on the program. But the way that it was written, it's also a guarantee. And so what's interesting for the Boston Housing Authority is that we, after 1999, we did a series of redevelopments where we took down dense brick buildings and we replaced them with townhomes. I think a lot of folks have seen that kind of traditional public housing redevelopment, sort of clapboard townhomes from the 2000s. The upshot of that is that we de-densified and ended up with fewer units. So that was kind of the story for us of the redevelopment that happened in the 2000s. And then when we got to the Obama administration, we started to have a commitment to one-for-one replacement. And so we started only doing redevelopments that were one-for-one replacements, but we'd really already shed those almost 3,000 units at that point. And now the phase, and I think the reason that I'm on today to talk with you all, is that we have moved not from de-densifying, from de-densifying to one-for-one replacement, to now we're really looking at how do we add public housing units again. And as the senator alluded to, really trying to do that in a mixed income way that builds those kinds of communities that are for every phase of the ladder. I will actually throw up a quote just to set the stage for a second. So I think folks can see. This is our mayor, Mayor Michelle Wu's State of the City address in January of this year, saying that, you know, from Chinatown to West Roxbury, public housing makes it possible for many of our seniors and veterans and residents with disability to stay in our city, and for so many of our young people to grow up here. Including we have two new city councilors who both grew up in public housing. And so the mayor announced that this year we'll identify locations for nearly 3,000 new public housing units to build over the next decade, which the federal government is going to provide more than $100 million a year to maintain. Now, before I continue with the slides, I just want to discuss that a little bit, because I think it's an important example of where in affordable housing and in housing, in public development, one of the things we need to do is think about what are the tools that we had already, and then think about how we can use them more creatively, but also be just really attuned to how things change. So in Boston, we have these 3,000 Faircloth units, but they used to be basically impossible for us to build because the subsidy associated with them was a public housing subsidy, which was a very low amount of money per unit per month. And so you basically couldn't possibly, you couldn't use that amount of money to leverage the debt to build them. And if you had somehow built them, you would have immediately been running into the red. But recently, HUD in July issued a notice that said that now, if you create those units, you can actually get their permission to top them up to the voucher rents that we pay in the private market in Boston. And so for us in Boston, that's a total game changer. I guess I actually have a slide on this, so I'll just, again, share my screen for a moment. This kind of explains this, right? So we're getting about $800 a month for a two-bedroom unit. That's nothing like what you need to operate it. That's why our public housing deals with such a huge capital backlog. At BHA alone, we have probably about $1.5 billion in capital backlog. So it was very hard for any prior administration to contemplate adding to that capital backlog with more units with those kinds of needs and inadequate subsidy. But then when HUD issued this updated guidance in 2023, they basically said we could go to the zip code payment standard. And what that did was it unlocks $2,000 a month per unit. So for Boston, these units went, the sort of unbuilt 3,000 units that we have went from being worth $40 million a year to $110 million a year. So that's like a $70 million a year operating subsidy change for Boston. So that's a pretty enormous thing. But it's a window of opportunity because HUD is sort of running this as a pilot, and you're only guaranteed the right to do this if to top up to the voucher rents. If you tell them the locations of all the units by September 30th this year. So here are our first two projects that we know are going to have Faircloth units in them. And these are the ones that are already moving trains. So they're exciting mixed use projects that Boston is proposing to use ARPA dollars on before those dollars expire. So they're going to be obligated by the end of this year and then spent by 2026. So these are projects that are moving into construction. On the left, we have the a parcel in Chinatown. This is actually a project on a city-owned parking lot that has just been serving the purpose of, parking some cars and getting some revenue for the city for a long time. And what it's now going to have is the colorful kind of autumnal colored building in the center, the lower center of this image is the one that's proposed. So it's in an already dense area. It's going to be quite a tall building. Both these buildings are kind of in the 112 to 130 unit range. And this is actually the one in Chinatown is going to be a mix of home ownership, both affordable and market and affordable rental. And amongst the affordable rental, we are going to have some Faircloth units. And so what we're really excited about is that this is a chance for us to put new public housing units in a neighborhood right downtown with a ton of amenities, with a mixed community, and to do it on city land and with ARPA dollars. And then to the right, the West End Library, this is a one-story library site today. So today the city just has a one-story building next to the white 10-story building that you can kind of see in the background there. And so the insight is basically, hey, if we can go that tall next door, let's go that tall on the public site. And again, we're going to have, this is going to be a mixed income building with a significant tranche of Faircloth units and a branch library on the ground floor. And interestingly, when we did the public engagement for this site, we were kind of going in with the question of, hey, should we be thinking about seniors or should we be thinking about family housing? And we ended up with a proposal to split and do both because the real users of the branch library are both young children and a lot of our seniors during the day. And everyone in the community was kind of like, those are the people who use the library. Both of them should get to live above the library. And so we really felt pretty excited about that. So these are a few more. These will mean more to those on the call who know Boston. But these are examples of types of locations that we've been looking at. As I said, we have to identify for HUD where we're going to put 3,000 units before September. So we're kind of in a race to do that right now. And some examples are above a public school in one of our neighborhoods. We've got somewhere we think we could maybe do a supportive housing high rise where there's actually already some service providers on site, which we think would be a great combination. There's a large campus style redevelopment in one of our more expensive neighborhoods. There's some industrial land in the Seaport, an almost entirely expensive neighborhood that's sprouted up in Boston, really doesn't have much affordable housing at all. We think there's a good opportunity here. There's a site where we've got folks who with developmental disabilities who have been living really ensconced in a neighborhood over time, and we need to we really want to actually do a build that would help them stay there in an accessible way on site because they've lived almost their whole lives at this site and now they're aging and they need different, more accessible housing. And so there's an opportunity to build that while also adding some units. There's a decommissioned boiler plant of ours. There's a site of ours that just has a few units but has a bunch of land around it. And there's a place where we think there might be an opportunity to do something in combination with an arts use on a that the city's proposing. So none of those are locked down. Those are all ideas, but they're examples of the types of things that we're thinking about when we think about where we'll put these fair cloth units. And one of the really important points that I want to note under this takeaway is that Boston, and I think this is important for everyone who's thinking about public development at all income levels, but especially when you're citing affordable units, including in mixed income development, is to think about how we affirmatively further fair housing, how we make sure that you don't just concentrate low income units in one part of your city or one part of your county, which is what has historically happened. And so we're big supporters of the affirmatively furthering fair housing principle that says you don't just not discriminate. You think about how we affirmatively use federal resources, which is what fair cloth units are, to really anchor our community in every part of the city, because we think the city belongs to people from every walk of life, at every income, all parts of it. So that's a big key thing about our approach. So then I wanted to talk just a little bit about what this looks like for an organization like ours, and then I'll talk a little bit about the broader capital stack and how we think about the overall money piece of this thing. But I mentioned that we need to reserve sites for all of these units by September 2024. Then there's an internal capacity question. So one of probably the greatest challenges for public agencies like ours to get back in the business of development again. And again, for many public agencies like ours, it's a question of getting back. Because like I said, we had a more muscular era where we built more things, and then we kind of moved out of that and left it to the private side, which just is an engine that's broken at this point. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But the challenge with getting back is that over time, we laid off those capacities on the public side. So the question is, how do you hire folks to do a pipeline of projects like this? We're talking about 3,000 units over 10 years. That means it's 300 units a year. But realistically, this is the planning year. So it's probably, you know, more like 400 units a year. And so we really need to build that capacity. What I remind my team of all the time is that the public needs to be mindful of the assets that it has and the advantages that it has. A regular developer who, you know, was looking to build a 3,000 unit, or in fact, when we're talking about fair cloth, because we're going to do a lot of mixed income buildings, we're talking about more than 3,000 units of development, like considerably more. A developer trying to do such a thing would kill any private developer for the land and land use powers and bonding capacity and public goodwill and ability to like work with sister agencies that we as a public entity have. So I think that sometimes it's important for us to kind of shake ourselves out of the headspace of, oh, the disadvantages of the public side is that they haven't done a lot of this work before, and see all of the advantages that the public side has. And then in our case, we actually have a pretty lengthy experience of working side saddle with private partners on redevelopment on our land. It's just been redevelopment that's been owned by the private side. So we actually have a fair amount of project expertise as well. But I just think it's very important to start with a kind of asset focused headspace when we think about the when we think about what it means for us to get into public development. So that's a little bit about kind of like fair cloth and how this came to be, why it is right now that we're recognizing this resource. And then in terms of the model that we're planning to use, so it's a couple of things. One is that in Boston, we went several years ago to small area fair market rents, which is where the voucher rents for the fair cloth units actually track the market. So what we're doing is we're using a kind of market-like funding mechanism that frankly has mostly existed so far to profit the private side, right? Like mostly voucher holders across the country are being housed by private landlords who are then pocketing a federally backed, almost market equivalent rent, especially in places like ours where we pay up to the median of the zip code instead of just the median of the whole region. So that's been like a huge public resource of wealth that has mainly accrued to the private side. So a big piece of what we're doing here is we're just channeling that resource over to the public side of the ledger. So we're saying, hey, instead of the BHA just RFPing away subsidy for private folks who want to build things, let's actually use it for our own deals. And the benefit of that is that, as I always like to say, and it sometimes drives private folks a little crazy, but the public actually has the opportunity to be much more efficient in these real estate deals, because we're not trying to satisfy the profit needs that you are on the private side, right? And so that's actually like a huge cost source. If you think about like the profitable return that they need, we need, the Senator referenced at the start about kind of revenue neutral. Like, we need these projects to be self-sustaining long-term. We have seen what happens when they're not. We get these major capital maintenance backlogs and really vulnerable properties, right? And that's like, that's how we've had to live as public housing authorities in this country. And it's not a sustainable model. So we need things to be sustainable, but we don't need things to be sustainable returning double digit returns, right? That's just not what we need to do. And so we have the opportunity to structure these deals using a subsidy that the private side would use, and to instead, like, you know, funnel the money that we're getting out of that either into the deals themselves to help make them pencil, which is why they can pencil in a moment like this, where they might not be penciling on the private side, or if we are going to make some profit off of them, be able to plow it back into a revolving fund to do the next deal. I figured that because Stanley, I know, has been chatting with everybody in the public development world, and we're closely connected to CPE and Montgomery County and some of the folks who are a little bit ahead of us on the revolving fund model. I thought I wouldn't give an extended presentation on that tonight. But just to say that for us, we basically see the opportunity to create, in Boston, we have 20% inclusionary development as a requirement anyways. It's actually 17% plus 3% vouchers. As is, that's kind of the new policy here. So the interesting thing for us is that when we put faircloth units into a building instead, we're actually making those buildings easier to pencil, because the faircloth rents that they pay to the landlord are much higher than the rents that our IZ units pay. So we're actually have the opportunity to either expand the proportion of faircloth units in that building. So have it, you know, instead of it being an 80-20, have it be a 70-30 or more, or it might enable us to subsidize some middle income tranche, which is ironically the hardest thing to cross subsidize right now, is that middle part of the ladder that I mentioned at the start, because we have these this access now to these high federal rents for the very low income folks, and we have very high market rents, both of which, when you take out the extraordinary return expectation of real estate investment trusts, which you can do if you have a revolving fund, if you have public money that's financed off of kind of lower bond rate returns, you have some money. You can basically make these deals pencil, but if you try to add the middle income tranche, you have to sort of figure out how you're going to pull the money to cross subsidize that. I dwell on that because I think it's often a counterintuitive thing. People assume that it's the lowest income units that are the hardest to build. That's true if you don't have federal subsidy, but with federal subsidy, it's not actually true. And the BHA, I said this towards the start, but our priority is those lowest income folks. BHA is proud to have had a homeless priority in who we house for almost two decades now. And as a result, we house one of the lowest income cross-sections of, I think, any housing authority in the country. Our average resident in Boston who lives in BHA housing is at 17% of area median income. That's very, very low. It's less than $20,000 a year for the household. That's obviously an average, so people are on either side. But those are the people who were focused on housing. You know, when the question comes of, if those are the focus people you're focused on housing, why do you still take an interest in mixed income housing? It's both because we can cross-subsidize and unlock the opportunity to house more folks, but it's also because we talk to our folks and they want to be able to live in every neighborhood of the city, and they want to be able to live cheek by jowl with people from all walks of life. And we have lots of reason to think that that's important. That said, we're still going to build with our faircloth units, all affordable buildings, especially supportive and senior housing. We get a lot of benefit out of having the kind of like shared amenities, spaces, and services that, you know, that are done well within in a kind of unified program building. So we will have some of that, but our big focus is on how to go back to what we think of as a very like proud and important mission of the idea that the public should be in the house building, that we should be in that game. We should be in that game because the private side will always stop before there's housing for all, because the private side has a system that works on the basis of scarcity and that actually artificially drives up the price of this essential human need by making sure that people will fall through the cracks, so that people are desperate enough to sort of pay what's ultimately a kind of price gouge price. We think that public housing was designed to subvert that, to undercut it, in the same way that like tap water that comes out of the tap at a low price undercuts the water market, so that people can charge you a pretty price for luxury water, but they're not charging you $50 because it's your only way to get water to drink, right? And we think that public housing was designed to do the same thing for housing. But we think that the way that we learn from the first half of the 20th century is that we recognize that, like, you know, we really want this to be mixed in all across the city. And that means mixed into buildings. And it also means, as I mentioned before, having it be mixed in every neighborhood of the city as well. So we're really excited about this. It's a huge priority of the mayor's. I should say that everything that we build now at the BHA is fossil fuel free. And we're also in the midst of retrofitting all of our existing housing. So that's a big endeavor as well, which would take a whole different webinar to discuss. But it's great to have a housing mayor. It's great to have, you know, we feel like with the Federal Inflation Reduction Act money right now, with the support that we're getting from a big bond bill from our governor, Governor Healey, we've never had a kind of stronger support at three levels of government for what is undoubtedly a crisis. So that's my hopefully quick enough explanation of what we're up to in Boston, an ocean away. Would love to chat, Senator, or take some questions now, if that makes sense.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Kenzie, for that great overview over your plans. It's extremely informative. As our Hawaii listeners will know, the Hawaii Public Housing Authority has a 10,000 unit development program that's currently underway. I'm not sure whether any of those are going to be faircloth units, but we'll definitely follow up on that and see if this model would be applicable in our case as well. And as a reminder to our attendees, you can feel free to add any questions to the Q&A feature of this webinar. I'll get this started by talking about the housing plan of the city of Boston in general. How was it that the development of these faircloth units rose to the, you know, top of the priority list enough to be included in this plan and in the State of the City address, as opposed to sort of more traditional proposals such as upzoning?
Yeah, so, and I should say that, you know, the mayor is actually, we have an incredibly convoluted zoning system in Boston in which basically nothing is by right. And the mayor is working very hard to change that, to kind of rationalize it, and in particular work with community in every neighborhood and sort of talked collectively about how we want to grow, but then actually make those decisions like for our neighborhood rather than our current system by Boston in Boston is like a regime of exceptions. So nothing is allowed, but then anything could be allowed, but everything has to be an individual fight. And it does really slow things down. And it also, I think, sort of leaves literally everyone dissatisfied. So one of the mayor's big focuses is on that and on providing the opportunity for us to kind of predictably grow on the zoning side. But yeah, I think, so a couple of things about why this rose to the top. One thing is just that it's really important for the mayor and for me and I think like a ton of the elected officials in Boston that that those lowest income folks are able to live in Boston. And it's felt not just as like a thing that would be nice, but as a kind of moral necessity, because a lot of our low income communities, and you know, a lot of them are communities of color in Boston, they really like built the city and invested in the city at a time when people were like leaving the city. You know, you had white flight in Boston, you had that kind of like divestment from the urban core. And a set of people really like stuck with Boston and grew it and improved it and turned it into this amazing city that the reason it's like one of the most expensive places in the country is because everybody wants to come here and live here and stay here. And so it's like, for us, the idea that the people who have like knit the city together for so many decades would then be priced out of the city is just unacceptable. And so I think you like start from that premise. And then I think one of the things that's become really obvious to people over recent years is that that lowest tranche of housing, right, for the lowest income folks, will not happen just by trickling down, even through a very aggressive upzoning plan. And like, just, you know, we actually saw a housing boom in the last 10 years in Boston in terms of what was constructed. We're in a weird situation where the metro region has not been building housing. We have a whole set of surrounding suburbs that have built hardly any housing at all. And so as a result, we have a housing crisis for the region. But Boston actually built even more than it was committed to in its regional plan over the last 15 years. But that didn't result in units at this income tranche. Like, it's just too far below what the market, like you can moderate the market and you're just not getting to these folks. And the crazy thing in Boston is that it used to be that like in a given neighborhood, the BHA would be the ones who were housing, you know, the only low income seniors or like the only low income families that could live in this neighborhood. Now, often our families are the only families who can live in a neighborhood because we have a situation where housing's gotten so expensive and we're a university city as well, that like you've got whole neighborhoods where the most economical thing is for a landlord to charge 5 students to be in what would have been a 3-bed like family apartment. And so we're in a funny spot where like in Brighton, one of my neighborhoods, 85% of the families with children in Brighton live in the 2 census tracts that are BHA housing. So we've really become like the anchor for both the like how kids even get to grow up in Boston, and then on the other side of the spectrum, how seniors on a fixed income get to stay in the city. So I think that's a long answer to your question, but I think the point is that it's like a necessity for us to keep these folks anchored. And it became obvious that like focusing on building these faircloth units was the only real way to make sure that that happened.
Got it. Yeah, the political element is often the most difficult and complicated. So that's a really helpful description. We have a question in the Q&A section. Everyone deserves housing. How does mixed and inclusionary housing implement safeguards for those who are still in long-term rehabilitation, sexual, substance abuse, et cetera, while living in the community? And I guess I think this question is really focusing on those with additional needs in housing who may have very low incomes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that what's important, part of this is that you do need dedicated supportive housing resources. There are some people who they absolutely deserve housing and they need to have those supports on site, in place, and like existing prior, right? And so, you know, at the BHA, we have some folks who get public housing with us mixed in with the rest of our population. But when they get in, they actually get in through referral programs that come with an ongoing supportive element. So we've got service agencies that visit our properties to serve specific individuals. But there's also an increasing number of dedicated supportive housing buildings in Boston that are focused on serving that population. And, you know, it's different types of things. So we just opened a 14 unit kind of 3/4 sober house that is anchored by our project-based vouchers. That's really for folks who are sober but are still feeling like they need kind of a structured supportive community for that purpose, where everyone else in the building is also in that headspace. And that's a, you know, and that's not something where it would make sense to have that necessarily as a 200 unit thing, right? Like, it's a really lovely little 14 unit house and was really lovingly redone recently. And so that's like one example. We actually have a specific focus these days. It's interesting. There was a lot of elderly buildings, and then we had, you know, disabled, and in Boston, those two things got combined into elderly disabled buildings. And now the folks who were non-elderly disabled in those buildings are becoming elderly. And we're finding that folks who have some of those supportive needs who also are elderly can have some additional elements that need to be supported. I think I mentioned the accessibility, the retrofitting we're going to do for ADA accessibility for the developmentally delayed folks that we've got living in a congregate setting. So I think, you know, I think that what's really, when you're a public housing director, you know that what you want is for everyone to feel that they're living in dignified housing. And that does mean that what you can't do is you can't have a tenant who is going to be incredibly disruptive because they're being unserved to all the other families that live around them, right? Because those families also need to build, they need their housing to be a stable platform for their lives. And so I think that often those issues have come about because we've stuck people into housing and then not followed up with the services. And so I think we're housing first isn't supposed to be housing only, is I guess what I would say. I think you can't have a system where housing is a reward when people have, you know, solved everything in their life, because we all just have ongoing challenges in our lives, right? But I think that when you provide housing, you also have to provide a service profile that makes sense, and you need the money to do that. And so for us, one of the big things that going to small area fair market rents did for us in 2019 was it gave us some very high rents in voucher rents in expensive neighborhoods of the city of Boston, where because we're not trying to make those private profits, we instead get to spend the extra operating dollars on services. So ironically, all the biggest supportive housing buildings in Boston that have opened in the last few years have opened in expensive neighborhoods, because that's where the voucher rents support an ongoing, robust, supportive operating budget.
That's a fantastic development, because yeah. I think we all recognize the need to, you know, provide affordable and supportive housing in every neighborhood in the city. But speaking of that, have you run into resistance from traditional opposition, so-called NIMBYism, when citing these developments?
As I said, you know, I mentioned in my presentation that some of the places that we have ideas about, we haven't set that in stone yet. And so I'm sure we'll have conversations in every neighborhood. I think Bostonians, it's almost like we've reached this boiling point of housing unaffordability that, like, it's affecting almost everyone's lives. And even the handful of people who are lucky enough that they say bought a house in Boston 30 years ago, and so they've rode the value increases, even they, when you talk to them at their doorstep, which I have, I used to be an elected official. And I also, before that, I ran a successful ballot campaign for a tax, an additional surcharge to the property tax for us to pay for more affordable housing in the city. And it passed with 75% of the vote, because everybody was just like, this affects me. Or there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, I just think, like, we are at this point in the city where people recognize that we absolutely need housing affordability in every neighborhood, and we needed it yesterday, and so we need it now. That doesn't mean that you don't ever have abutters who say, oh, but not here. But I think the overall kind of, like, moral sensibility in the city is very much in that direction. And I think that it definitely helps us. And I will say that we've just had tremendous political support for, you know, we have development projects we're planning that I didn't talk about today because they predate the Faircloth proposal, but they're at Charlestown in South Boston. The BHA at each one has an 1,000 unit development, where it's proposed to replace those 1,000 units, but add 2,000 more market units. So it's like a tripling of the density. And each of those are developments. The South Boston one was built in the late 1930s. It was one of the first public housing developments in the country. And the Charlestown one was built in the 1940s. They need so much investment. And even though we did have some voices that were critical of the additional density, the, like, vast majority of folks said, yeah, no, these sites need investment, and this is how it's going to happen. So I think we've really appreciated the public support.
That's also super encouraging. Although maybe as things get closer, people tend to come out of the woodwork, right?
Yes, but Charleston and South Boston are permitted. So, but yes, for sure.
Can you take us through very quickly the steps in financing these projects? I know that you mentioned that they're going to be supported by the higher rents that the federal government will be providing. But, you know, could you start at step one? Does it start with an RFP? Do you then, you know, choose a private sector developer?
So it's interesting. So actually, I would say the Faircloth unit development is, there are several steps of the process that it's kind of agnostic on, and we're going to probably try a bunch of different things along the way. So the BHA can ourselves just, you know, we could build these units. I mean, we have to submit something called a NAR. It's a request for a notice of anticipated RAD rents to the feds, and then we go through a site and neighborhood standards vetting. So there's a series of HUD steps that you go through to get approval to use the Faircloth subsidy at a specific site. We can propose that. It could be a site that we BHA own, but it could also be a site another one of our public agency partners owns. We're actually really appreciating the partnership of the city and some other public agencies because of the fact that we want to make sure that we're siting these all over the city, including in places that we haven't had a lot of traditional public housing. So we don't want to just put them back on BHA land. And so, you know, that whole piece, BHA could then commission an architect, hire a GC, and do the work ourselves. We're aware that to do this many units in this shorter period of time, we are probably going to want a parallel process. So we are sort of, you know, there's a couple of different types of RFPs that you can put out for these deals. So one is the sort of traditional, what a lot of housing authorities have done and what we've done historically is you RFP out a site and you look for a private developer partner who then when the job is over is going to own the buildings, and we own the land. That's what we've traditionally done. And that's what we're doing in Charlestown and South Boston. I think the way that even those deals evolved from kind of that traditional model is that the BHA's ground leases in both those large mixed income deals are now built in a way that gives us something more like a real financial ownership stake. So instead of like your classic kind of $1 for 99 years type public lease to the private sector, those are leases where we not only get base rent, but we get percentage rent based on the revenues of the project, and we get transaction rents, so significant shares at transaction points when buildings are sold along the way. So those are, we aren't an owner, but we have this ground lease that kind of functions like a form of ownership. It's also a way that we may really protect the long-term affordability of the replacement units at those sites. But I think the other thing is to do a kind of turnkey development RFP where you say, hey, I'm putting out the opportunity to build this thing for me. And, you know, you'll be able to earn developer fee, but you're not going to have the ownership interest. So our comparison, you know, that I use around here is that we have Harvard across the river. They're a very large institution and they've recently been redoing each of their 12 dorms and they have hired, you know, private developers to do that work. And they pay them well for their professional services. But then at the end of the project, Harvard owns the dorm, right? Like the private developer doesn't own the dorm. And I think in many ways, like, you know, part of us being a bit more muscular about public development again is recognizing that we really don't need to give away the ownership stakes in exchange for professional services. I think that that was in many ways more an ideological decision than anything else. And it's not one that we need to stick with. There's also intermediate approaches, you know, I think Montgomery with the deal that they did, the first one they did with their revolving fund, I think they ended up with an 87% stake in the building and their developer with a 13% stake. So there's also, you know, taking a majority public ownership interest but letting there be a minority private ownership interest. So I think that's a route available too. Honestly, we're going to look at all these routes. It depends a lot on the specifics. Like, for instance, if the private side were bringing a really desirable site to the table, that might affect the conversation. So I think we'll do a bit of everything. But I think the really important thing is for the it's for the public side, in the interest of the public good, to act a little bit more like a capitalist. And it's actually the opposite of acting like a capitalist to give away the store, to like give away your assets. So I think often we've been like, oh, the the public side is thinking like a capitalist because they're giving all the capitalists their stuff in these public-private developments. Like, here, take my land, take my subsidy, you own it now. And it's like, no, like, let's think a little bit about what the public wealth is, right? That's being held in these various forms. And let's make sure that the real long-term value accrues to the public side.
That's a point that I think has been gaining a lot of traction here in Hawaii recently, because we've seen how inefficient some of these subsidies are that are targeted at the private sector. I'm a big believer that the low-income housing tax credit is unfairly weighted towards the private developers and against the public sector. And so I think a lot of the successful systems that we see, like in Singapore, like in Vienna, they actually don't take any more public subsidy on a year-to-year basis to build new housing. Their new housing construction is expected to pay for itself, and it does. But the way that they do that is that they target the middle income residents so that they're not, you know, paying deep subsidies. So it sounds like with the new HUD faircloth policies, Boston is able to take advantage of this loophole where the very lowest income residents will be generating a rent that is equivalent to what a high income resident would generate. But beyond the 3,000 units that are part of this plan, if you could very quickly, since we're near the end of the time here, let's say we were to go back to Boston. I'm planning to attend my 20th college reunion there this summer. But let's say we fast forward to, I don't know, my 50th reunion in 30 years or 60th in 40 years. And the housing shortage is now over. No longer will Boston be one of the most expensive cities in the world to live. Can you give us the thumbnail as to how you think Boston achieved that 30 or 40 or however many years into the future?
Yeah, I think it's that we build the public development muscle. And as we do it, we also build more and more like into a revolving fund. And just become, I think the public just becomes the housing developer of choice, like in the city. You build a kind of virtuous cycle engine and you just get going and that enables you to do a bigger scale. I mean, the way I think about it is, I think politically, the city could not put a big chunk of money into building a mostly market without that deep affordable tranche development in Boston right now. It's too important to us to keep the really low income folks there. But if the city could really build that muscle, we could be, you know, the Boston Housing Authority in 40 years could be the housing authority, you know, the way that the Singaporean is, right? Like just like the place that people go to get safe, decent, affordable housing and at all income levels. And I think what's funny is like, you know, Paul Williams, who I think you've been in touch with as well, you know, I think has just a great point about like housing is a boom bust cycle. In this country, like private housing market, it's not obvious that we should allow housing to be a boom bust cycle. Like water's not a boom bust cycle. Electricity isn't, right? Like, it's just like, there are some things that you need and actually maybe we should just be producing them at a predictable scale to meet the demand and not have them be like a giant profitable sector in the same way. And like, will some people's plans for how they're going to feather their nest not work out if we make that change? Yes. But will a lot of people actually have housing? Yes. Right. And I think that's the thing for me is like, I think this is very much public development is very much a virtuous cycle thing where we need to start doing it to feel confident in our ability to do it at scale. Like we're not going to be able to just snap our fingers and suddenly switch to a system where we do it at scale, but I think we can get there.
That's a really inspiring note. We really appreciate your sharing the time, especially since it's now at night over there in Boston. And we really hope that here in Hawaii, at least, we can follow in your footsteps and that other jurisdictions will be able to do so as well. So thank you so much, Kenzie Bach, for joining us on Our Homes. And stay tuned for our next webinar, which we will be announcing in the near future. Thank you, everyone, for joining.